time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for June 8th, 2019. As you know, we mostly focus our show on cycling. And I'd like to think that you, the listener, is interested in not only many sports, but also the humanity and the need for honest and open discourse around those sports and the athletes who participate in them. Recently, there have been many heated discussions where a line is drawn in the sand. One side insists, usually very loudly, that gender discrimination, misogyny, racism, and sexism are rampant, often negating the best of intentions and effectively shutting down any meaningful dialogue. On the other side, there are some very well-reasoned, rational, and legal discussions on the topic. And to that end, we have one of the best legal sports minds on the show this evening. Nancy Hogshead Maker has won 3 gold medals and 1 silver in swimming at the 1984 Olympics, and she's a civil rights attorney. She is currently the CEO of Champion Women, an organization leading targeted efforts to advocate for equality and accountability in sport. Our conversation covers a lot of ground, including disturbing accounts of discrimination, flagrant violations of law, and some of the remedies that are finally being put in place, many of which can be attributed to the work she's doing. It's a fascinating and hopeful conversation. After a break and a couple of short news items, we'll chat with Kate Harley, the Active Transportation Director for the Ohio Department of Transportation. It's nice to be able to report some good things happening in Ohio, especially in light of the dismal record we have when it comes to vulnerable road users' fatalities. Ohio ranks a pitiful 40th out of the 50 states. But Kate has a new initiative, Your Move Ohio, and with statistics to back her up, offers some good ideas for Ohioans on the road. So let me introduce you to the force that is Nancy Hogshead Maker. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks so much for joining me on the show this week.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Well, I am pretty excited about talking to you. I've heard amazing things about you. I've been reading about you. And we have a sort of broad set of topics to discuss. Can you give us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, how you became interested in sports, and how that has led not only to your Olympic success, but what you're doing now?
Sure. I probably started swimming the same way everybody starts swimming. And I mean, I was doing lots of different sports up until I was 11 years old. But I started swimming. My parents bought a boat. They just wanted to round proof the kids. So I swam with my older brother, who did not like swimming, and my younger sister, who did not like swimming. But I did. My first coach ever was, tell me how lucky is this, was Eddie Reese, who is now the head coach at University of Texas. He's been there for 30 plus years and he's probably had, I don't know, 50, 70 Olympians. So I had the best start one could possibly imagine. And when I was 11, my family moved to Jacksonville, Florida, and I got another great coach. And that was Randy Reese, who has had the same number of Olympians. Both of them are Hall of Fame coaches. And he's the one who said, you know, Nancy, if you want to be great, you can be great, but you're going to have to do it. Because I used to miss practices all the time and wasn't very serious when I got there. And so he changed that. And anyway, that's kind of, you know, how I got into elite sport. And I just can't tell you the importance of my teammates and being part of a group that was all thinking about really high level, you know, the Olympics type level at a relatively early age.
Yeah. So not having grown up in that kind of environment, I guess I never understood about the commitment of even young people to having to practice and having to show up and having to be on in those situations. So I can really appreciate what you're saying now in hindsight, knowing what I know about Olympians, having talked to many of them, including you. So, wow, really interesting.
But I do have to say, one thing about our sports industry right now is that it's very good at getting money out of parents' pockets. And I have three kids, so I know how this whole game works.
I'll bet you do.
Yeah, and that is, it's way too much, way too soon. So a 10-year-old should not be doing two-a-day practices or doing any sport year-round. If you're really interested in this topic, the Aspen Institute puts out really good information. It's called Sport and Society. It's run by a guy, Tom Ferry, that as an example, my first coach, Eddie Reese, I was in my first race and my mom said, hey, Eddie, look, Nancy's really close to the state record. I bet if you push her, I bet she can get that state record. And he said, if I push her, she's going to quit. And he was right. He never pushed me. I never got the state record, but I did stay in the sport.
How interesting.
Yeah. So I really had it pretty ideal. Probably 11 is when I, as I said, got started serious. That's probably a little too young. This idea about travel teams and going to big competitions at an early age, you know, wait till puberty till you start specializing in a sport.
Very interesting. So I see a lot of parents pushing their kids to doing things that probably they wanted to do as opposed to really have their kids do. It's like they're trying to relive their own lives through their kids. And these kids are really, I think they're struggling in some way when I think about it that way. I mean, I had a couch potato for a kid who now, as an adult, you know, does Zumba 5 days a week and has a personal trainer and does all this stuff, but that's on her. You know, that is not something I push. So I totally get what you're saying, a lot of what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you another quick story that my mother hates, but, you know, it's true. So I was 14 years old. I broke my first American record. And I broke it in prelims. In swimming, you have prelims and then finals. And so I called home and I was crying and I was like, Mom, I just broke your record. She goes, good. She goes, did you get in finals? Right. Yeah, Mom, I got in first. I just went faster than anybody's ever been before. And she goes, oh, good. Now, what stroke do you swim?
My goodness.
I swam the butterfly, Mother. And she goes, oh, I like it when you swim the backstroke because I can see your face. Okay, so swimming is not their gig. It's not
clearly.
Yeah, but I tell you what, they made it happen. They paid for it. It was not an inexpensive endeavor. I had to move away from home at 15 with a whole other household expense. You know, but they made it happen.
Yeah.
So good for them, even though it wasn't their interest.
It wasn't their gig. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Nancy Hogshead Makar. She is a four medal Olympian, if I'm not mistaken. 3 gold, 1 silver. Is that correct?
There you go.
Got that one right. But more importantly, she's involved with women in sport. And that's what we're going to talk about mainly today. There's a lot of controversy about women in almost every field. Give us a little bit of background on the work you're doing, and then we're going to break some of that down.
Sure. Right after the Olympics, Donna DeVerona came and talked to the whole Olympic team and said that she said, you're about to become famous. I was like, and then she goes, and what are you going to do with it? And I had never thought about it that way. She was so smart to have us sort of orient towards, you know, doing something for good. And she hoped that it had to do something with Title IX. And I knew about Title IX because I was number one, a women's studies minor. And I knew that I owed my college scholarship to that statute. So every time somebody would stick a microphone in my face, I would start talking about how grateful I was for Title IX because it was a Supreme Court decision that had just ruled that Title IX didn't apply to most colleges and universities to athletics, that it only applied to the part of the school that got the federal funds, right? So if your student loan program got federal funds, that's how most schools get our tax dollars, then that part couldn't discriminate. But the housing program, the math program, and your athletic program could do whatever it wanted to. So it took 4 years, but we did get a statutory, but that's kind of what got me into it. I got an intern with the Women's Sports Foundation between my junior and senior year in college. And then, I was off to the races.
Explain how
what I do now.
Well, I know a lot of what you do now, but I know my listeners don't know that. But I guess, I guess one of the things I want to know is whether institutions are in or out of compliance with Title IX. What's happening with Title IX now? It pops up as a topic occasionally, but I'm not sure how it's working countrywide.
Okay. Title IX is a federal statute that says that schools that receive federal funds, which is almost all of them, cannot discriminate based on sex. Okay. And so there are a lot of different ways that you can discriminate against somebody based on sex. You can discriminate against them because they're pregnant. You can discriminate against them and not allow them into the math class. Or you can not do anything about sexual violence that's happening on your campus. There are lots of ways that schools can discriminate. So we, at my organization, is called Champion Women, and we provide the legal advocacy. I'm a civil rights lawyer for girls and women in sports. And we try to do the policy things that individual lawyers can't necessarily do. So we do the, making sure the statute stays strong and that how it applies in all these different ways related to sports is us. So whether or not it's employment, whether or not it's as an athlete, whether or not it is as a pregnant athlete, whether or not it is, whether or not you're getting the same scholarships or the opportunity to play or getting treated the same way that the male athletes do, that's all in our roundhouse, as we say.
And are schools non-compliant?
Yeah. Most schools,
that was a loaded question.
Yeah. That is a loaded question because, again, the umbrella of Title IX, there are lots of different ways to discriminate based on sex. And so they may be in compliance when it comes to athletics and not so in compliance when it comes to pregnancy, as an example.
Hmm.
But when it comes to overall compliance, probably not. Unfortunately, the athletics part of the equation requires that you've got to have a student bring a lawsuit. Most students, if they want to be able to participate in, let's say a track and field, they only apply to programs that already have track and field programs. They don't go to a school to bring a lawsuit. And they're there for such a short time. When it comes to the law, it sounds like 4 years is a long time, but not so much. So we are, as a nonprofit organization, we are sending out letters to all different schools to let them know exactly how they're not in compliance. There's a database that you can go to. It, just type in EADA into your Google search bar, and usually the first thing that comes up will be the Equity in Athletics Disclosure Act. And it has all kinds of great data in it. We use, and the data comes from the school. We write letters to the school that is a short one that goes to it's kind of like your bottom line. It's okay, here's how you're out of compliance. We write a second letter that it gives the legal memo. It's all the background and everything else on, the case law and the statute and all that, the regulations on exactly why the school is out of compliance. Most of the schools that we write to right now, we're kind of starting with the worst of the worst, is they need to add anywhere, usually around 200, 150, 200 athletes to their sports program. They need to add over $1 million a year in their college scholarships. These are not, they're not small differences.
No,
like
they're
add
huge.
One or two teams.
Wow.
Yeah, they need to add in some schools they have to double the size of their women's athletic department in order to be in compliance. And there's some people make their living off of making the law so difficult to understand that like you have to rely on their expertise. And we try to do the exact opposite, which is we try to make it so digestible and so easy to understand that anybody would understand it, right? That this is, it's not rocket science,
right?
As I say, it's something that everybody can understand exactly how you measure men's sports and women's sports. I always like to use the example of my own daughters who played softball, and on their second or third practice pulled me aside and said, "Hey, Mom, how come the boys have a scoreboard and we don't have a scoreboard? Why do they have restrooms and we don't have restrooms? Why do they have stands and we don't? Why do they have dugouts and we don't? Why?" It's like they had gone down in Title IX parlance, it's called the laundry list. And, you know, they had gone down the laundry list and they had taken a class on how to measure whether or not the programs were equal. Yes, there is this laundry list, but in truth, if you ask people, are you getting, or if you ask the girls and or the women, are you getting the same opportunity that the men are getting? They know one way or the other, and they know exactly how they're not getting it. It's because you have separate but equal in sports that you don't have in the math class. Some of those kinds of discrimination are much more hidden. Athletics, not so much. So, yeah, so there's a lot of problems there. There's also a lot of problems with pregnancy discrimination, because most athletes, most people who become pregnant as part of their athletic team feel such shame. It's usually an unplanned pregnancy. They're not married. Our society is not kind to young, unmarried, pregnant women. And they just don't know what their rights are. They have really strong rights. They absolutely should expect what most employees should expect, which is they won't be fired for it, that they won't lose their scholarship, that they won't lose their place on the team, that they'll be given ample time to be able to recover before they're expected to get back on the team, that they can stay on the team as long as the doctor says it's okay for them to be on the team, that the coach can't say, "I don't want the distraction." And the NCAA actually gives pregnant athletes 6 years to complete 4 years of education. So most other athletes, you have 5 years. You can have one redshirt year. So pregnant athletes, right? But again, most students don't know that. And so they kind of slink away without recognizing, like, oh, you're really protected here.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Nancy Hogshead Makar. We are speaking about Title IX, women in sports, and we're going to move to some more sort of pertinent to our show stuff, because the Olympics are coming up in 2020. You know what? Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Olympics. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Nancy Hogshead Makar. She is an Olympian, a past Olympian. She is a civil rights attorney, and she has an organization called Champion Women, which is really important as some of the issues that have been coming up. You know, such high-profile cases such as the Michigan doctor, the Ohio doctor, these guys who have been abusing women. I know that's a big part of what you work with. But I want to talk about the Olympics, because 2020 is next year. And something I did not know, but I learned from your terrific video on your site, is that the U.S. Olympic Committee is not bound by civil rights laws. What does that mean? And how is that going to affect especially women athletes?
Sure. Well, most of our civil rights laws are tied to either parts of commerce or giving the federal funds. The rights that we protect employees, as an example. Well, athletes are not employees. So most people are protected under Title VII, protects people from being discriminated based on race or color or national origin or sex. And so they're not covered under employment laws. And they don't receive federal funds, and they're not educational institutions, so they're not covered by Title IX. So, yikes. That means if somebody is discriminated against, they don't have the normal recourse that others would have. To make matters worse, do you want me to go into the sexual abuse work that we do?
Oh, yeah. I think it's in everybody's mind. I mean, all these super high-profile cases.
Right. So the United States Olympic Committee for years, worked very hard to create case law to say that the USOC did not owe athletes a legal duty to protect them from sexual abuse, that that was the police's problem. It was the club's problem. It was the, you know, it just, it wasn't something that they did. And let me give you an example. In the law, in order to sue somebody for negligence, if you want to say your carelessness caused me harm, right, you have to show four things, and you'll see law school students walking around saying duty breach, causation, damages. So you have to have those four things. You have to have a duty to one another, right? So if you're driving, you owe a duty to the other drivers. You have to breach that duty. You have to do something that is not, that is, you were careless. That carelessness has to cause somebody else harm, and you actually have to suffer damages. If it's just sort of a whoops, you know, and nobody suffers any out-of-pocket harm, then there's usually no liability. So you have to have all four of those things. So what the USOC, their legal response was, we don't owe the athlete a legal duty, meaning that let's say you and I, Diane, are walking across the street, and I happen to know, just like the USOC knew, that this was a very dangerous intersection, just like the USOC knew that that sports was a very dangerous, it created this crazy risk of harm of sexual abuse far higher than other endeavors. So let's say I know it, and I know you don't know it, and I don't do anything. And sure enough, you go get hit by a car, or an athlete gets hit by a sexual pedophile, then you can't sue me, because I don't owe you a legal duty. But if I say, Diane, watch out, this is the dangerous intersection here, and let's say that I don't help you across it in a way that actually prevents you from getting harmed, and you end up getting harmed, then you can sue me, because I assumed a duty over you to help you get across the street, and I didn't do it very well. So the USOC was kind of like, hands off, not my problem. And so we had to actually go to Congress and get them to add, one of the purposes of the Olympic Committee now is to protect athletes from physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, that it gave them this legal duty to protect athletes from abuse.
So this is just mind-boggling to me that organization that deals with young athletes, which is what the USOC does, and bringing them onto a world stage, would right. not want to do everything in their power to protect those athletes on all fronts. It, to me, it is just mind-boggling.
If you really look at athletes, the Olympic Committee looks at athletes as fungible. These are, there's somebody else that's going to come and take your place. This is, they make money off these athletes, but are they truly interested in their well-being? So the Champion Women is part of a group called Team Integrity, and we are interested in making sure that athletes have more voting rights with the USOC, so that they have half the board voting rights. You better believe if athletes had half the voting rights, that they would have made sure to protect, they would have voted to spend the money differently than how the USOC executives were spending the money is on themselves. They paid themselves very well. They traveled extravagantly. I mean, in just the nicest hotels in the world with first-class travel. Meanwhile, all the athletes are traveling coach, and they would have to bypass, you know, rather than going the most direct route, they went there, whatever the cheapest route was. And let me tell you, for an athlete, it really matters how they travel. It really doesn't for an executive.
No.
So, no, they were out to enrich themselves off of this. Allie Reisman, the great Allie Reisman, who spoke so powerfully and so vulnerably against Larry Nassar, her mom told me that she made $1,000 a month for most of her career. So most of these athletes are, like, how they're distributing money is, like, the executives get it all.
So let me
athletes, almost none.
Let me ask a question about women Olympic athletes as opposed to men Olympic athletes. So right. Take the same Allie Reisman, who, you know, was just one of the finest, and then compare her to whoever the guy was who might be her counterpart. How was he treated? Did he get any better treatment than she did by the committee?
When it comes to sexual abuse, you mean, or when it comes
I meant to pay, you know, parity and to travel and to. I mean, I guess my understanding was a lot of these Olympians had to almost pay for their own travel, their own.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The whole Olympic movement, the International Olympic Committee, all over the world, they abolished the idea of this "quote unquote" amateur back in 1992. But the idea that you still have to come from wealth in order to be able to make the team has not gone away. So, I don't know, skiers in particular, you know, the executives are making well over $500,000 a year. And the athletes have to basically pay for their own way. I mean, who suffers the most are women athletes who are on a team sport like hockey and soccer, where there's a men's comparable sport, and they're just getting nowhere near what the men are getting. And the executives, rather than just doing the right thing, they wait until the athletes have done this enormous amount of work to lock down their peers and their peers' peers and their peers' peers' peers to make sure that there's nobody who will break a strike, to go to the national governing body, USA Hockey, and say, we want a living wage, we want health insurance, we want, and to have Dave Ogden, was the head, he just retired, he was the head of USA Hockey, he said, you know, I wondered when you were going to show up. I mean, this guy, I mean, how dare he wonder when the athletes were going to demand something that he should have been doing. He was intentionally discriminating based on sex.
What a jackass. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Let me remind our listeners again. We're speaking with Nancy Hogshead Makar. Just an unbelievable conversation. I want to just sort of take this over to the cycling part for a moment, because sure. I know that women's cycling right now is undergoing sort of this resurgence. There's a lot of chatter. There are a lot of great women riding today, and yet facing the same kinds of issues. You can go all the way back into the 80s and hear of things for women who were not treated well. Certain women were. And today we've got women who just are just riding their butts off, and they still are not making any money.
Right.
And so I'm wondering what we can do to not only protect these women, but to make them successful. What is it, especially your organization, which is that's what it does, Champion Women. What are you asking us to do to help?
Well, we have a number of proposals. You can go onto our website, but we have a number of proposals that we've given to Congress right now for them to restructure the Olympic Committee so that USA Cycling couldn't treat women athletes differently than its male athletes, that it would have to compensate them the same way, that it would have to provide them with the same training opportunities, the same quality coaching, medical care, et cetera. The way that most national governing bodies, you know, if let's say, I don't know, Nike or Subaru or whoever sponsors a national governing body, they sponsor both the men and the women, right? So, you know, they usually don't sex segregate the sponsorships. So that should be divided equally.
One would think.
Yeah. There's another great group out there called the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sports. And they have a whole hashtag on Twitter that I recommend people follow called Here's Proof, hashtag HERESPROOF. That, you know, when people say like, oh, people aren't interested in girls' sports or women's sports. And then you see like, you know, thousands of people who are flowing into women's arenas. And so people take a picture of it and say, here's proof. And
interesting.
So my girls, as I said, they're really into softball. They just, you know, watch every game and they know all the players and they want me to tweet out, you know, congratulations to different players. And it's great. I mean, they're right. So, but still, like, these, you have to understand, like, sports, what we do is that nexus between sport and sexism. So sexism affects women throughout society, whether it's their physical safety or whether it's their pay or whether it's the opportunities that they get or, you know, et cetera. But it affects sports, I think, more profoundly or at a greater disparity, because sports is where we prove masculinity, where we it has been the training ground for soldiers and for, you know, being quote unquote real men. And so because there is this hyper masculine ethos that's behind sports, these, you know, the sort of people want to emphasize the masculine qualities of human qualities, that it really hinders women's participation in it, right? So you can see it almost every way, whether it's participation, whether it's coaching or officiating, or, you know, in all these different areas, women get less. Any way that you can measure men's and women's sports in all these arenas, you know, you get less. A good, great example is we've got one of the best coaches in the world who has won the World Cup with Jill Ellis. She's the coach, the head coach of the women's soccer team, and she cannot get a job coaching men.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, she may not want to, but it's the fact that she can't do it. And it's the fact that, like, there are real biological reasons why we segregate men's and women's sports, right? Why we say men go here and women go here. But there is no reason to sex segregate employees,
right?
Coaches, officials. There's no biological or societal reason why we should sex segregate those. And yet women are effectively locked out of the market of coaching men.
Unbelievable. So there's one topic that I want to touch on that is, it's come up recently on my show. I'm working on another show that's going to be dedicated specifically to it. And that is participation in sports by LGBTQ and trans athletes. Mm-hmm. We are seeing a particularly public conversation about a runner. We've got running, we've got track, we've got cycling, we've got all of these sports.
Sure.
What are some of the issues that you see that face these athletes, and how are they being addressed, if they are?
Well, you know, different people come down policy-wise very different than others. So I recognize that there, but I would like to have the discussion based on where do you come down on the science, and then what policies flow from that science. So the science is irrefutable that the levels of testosterone that men have, that no women approach it, no XX woman approaches even remotely close to the testosterone that men have. They're sort of two separate graphs, if you will, that women are basically 0.5 to 1.6, maybe 2 on a few outliers. And men start around 8 and go up from there, like to 25. So they have a totally separate graph. And that testosterone is that is why we sex segregate men and women, right? You could just have one team and, you know, see who makes it, and women just would not get very many opportunities if that's how you sex segregated those things. So as soon as you recognize that, some people say, well, it's so important for trans athletes to have recognition and to be accepted, to be loved, and to affirm what their gender is, that they should be able to participate in the women's category without taking any gender-affirming hormones, okay? It's a societal reason as to why they should be able to participate. I get that. There's another argument that I'm much more in favor of, which is because testosterone gives athletes such a unique advantage over others, that until they can assure that the testosterone is not giving them this unfair advantage, then they should not compete as women. There, right? There are some people that are saying, oh, we need to have a separate category of trans athletes. Yeah, it could be. You know, we do it for blind athletes and for athletes that are missing a limb or have cerebral palsy. You know, we might want to do that for trans athletes as well, But I do think that women's sports is worth protecting. That women's sports, that protecting XX, Caster Semenya is a very noble woman. And I'm not kidding. I mean, I'm not just saying, like, she is a woman. She was born a woman. She is a woman. But she has XY chromosomes, the Cas position just related to XY. And she has male ranges of testosterone, again, nowhere near where women are. And third is that testosterone is what's called, quote unquote, bioavailable. Some people have lots of testosterone, but they don't absorb it, right? So they usually look kind of like model skinny, right? So you want to say, are they, quote unquote, androgenized, right? So you need all three things in order to have the Cas decision apply to this athlete. You have to have XY chromosomes. You have to have male levels of testosterone, and that testosterone has to be available, right? All three things. And if that's true, regardless of what the genitalia is or how somebody's raised or what they identify as, that if you think that protecting women's sports and giving X women an opportunity to win, to be on the medal stand, then that's what we need to protect. So, again, I recognize that there are differences of opinion here, but I hope that we can have the conversation based on what is the science and what policy decisions flow from there, instead of calling each other racist or sexist or misogynist or et cetera, instead of name calling.
I so appreciate that. I so appreciate that, because that's what it's sort of come down to. It's sort of like somebody drew a line in the sand, and you've got the people on the one side screaming at the people on the other side.
Yeah.
That you are this, without taking into consideration all of the science. And that's sort of why this other show hasn't happened yet, is I'm trying to find all of the science I can find to put it together.
Yeah, I'm happy to send you that.
Let's talk about Champion Women once again before we wrap this up. What do you want us to do to support your work? And I want to know if men as well as women are welcome to work with you.
Oh, of course men are welcome to work with us. We've had a number of research assistants who have just done phenomenal work. So absolutely, first of all, we need funds. So in order to do this work, we have to employ people. Not everybody can work for free.
Right.
Very few people can. So we've got to have the resources to be able to do this. And any donation that you can make is highly appreciated, really appreciated. So two is, if somebody's in school, needs research assistance, needs an externship. I was a professor of law for 12 years. I know how to work with that skill set, that usually typically age group, but not always, to help them become better lawyers or help them become better advocates. People who are, our social media, if you go on to on Facebook, on Champion Women, and on Twitter, it's I Champion Women. We try to bring up a lot of issues there. Our metric that we look for is whether or not we post something is it value added? Does it teach somebody something that they didn't know beforehand? Does it help them be better advocates for themselves? The best thing that can happen to me is when a family calls, because I know I can make their lives better. So a family that's willing to push it, a family that's not afraid to either sue their university or stand up for what's right and let us help them. Yeah, so those are all the things that we need. I mean, honestly, the best thing people can do is to write us a check. If you go on to championwomen.org, you can make a donation right through there, and I get an email right away.
says, favorite part of the day.
Yeah, exactly, that we got that donation.
This has just been a fascinating conversation, I knew it would be. Everybody told me it would be. And I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me about it. Once again, we've been talking with Nancy Hogshead Makar. She is an Olympian. She is a civil rights attorney. And she is a champion for women. It's championwomen.org. Thank you so much for talking with me today. We will talk again.
Thanks, Diane. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right.
Nancy Hogshead Makar joined me from her office at championwomen.org. If you're interested in learning more, and especially if you are interested in becoming involved, you can log on to championwomen.org. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, I have a couple of news items before we chat with ODOT's Kate Harley. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We've had a couple of victories this week, and unfortunately a couple of defeats, as cyclists are still being mowed down by behemoth cars and their often not-so-happy drivers. Case in point came on Friday when a woman named Liz Gonzalez, who's not particularly a cycling advocate, posted a video to Twitter and then to BarstoolSports.com titled, "This Morning I Witnessed a Guy Attempt to Murder a Biker with His Car." What Ms. Gonzalez witnessed, she understood as clearly an aggressive and potentially deadly act by some jerk who thought it was okay to drive his car into and across a crosswalk after the light turned red and then deliberately try to run a cyclist down. The cyclist, however, did not back down and fortunately was not hurt. If you are interested in seeing it, the video is only about 15 seconds long. You can find it at BarstoolSports.com. On the other hand, Allison Spurl, 21, left the courthouse in Lorain County, Ohio on June 6th, shortly after her attorney, Kenneth Liu, waived her pretrial hearing on charges of leaving the scene of a motor vehicle accident, a fifth-degree felony, tampering with evidence, a third-degree felony, assault and possession of criminal tools, both first-degree misdemeanors, obstruction of official business, a second-degree misdemeanor, failure to yield, and reckless operation, both minor misdemeanors. The charges stem from a crash around 4 p.m. May 15th, where Spurl allegedly struck a 51-year-old Bay Village woman on a bicycle near the intersection of Lake and Moore Roads and fled the scene before authorities arrived. The mother of three was fortunately saved by a nurse who was first on scene. We will be following this story as it winds its way through the courts, because of course it is right here in Northeast Ohio. And finally, Governor Jared Polis of Colorado signed Senate Bill 19-175 on Wednesday, May 29th at 11:30 a.m. at the Denver Bicycle Cafe, making Colorado's roadway safer for vulnerable road users like bicyclists, pedestrians, peace officers, construction workers, and more. Making our roads safer is one of our top priorities at Bicycle Colorado, and that's why we've been at the table for every conversation surrounding Senate Bill 175, said Piep van Hoeven, policy director at Bicycle Colorado. We worked with Senator Foote and Representative Roberts to introduce the bill, and we are proud to have passed the bill through both chambers with bipartisan support. That Governor Polis is putting his name behind the bill shows Colorado's leadership is committed to keeping everyone who uses our roads safe. Let's hope some other states follow suit. So you see, we do win some, we do lose some, but what I am seeing is a much higher profile campaign about the vulnerability of cyclists and pedestrians and the authorities who are taking notice. In response to a decade of statewide increases in fatal pedestrian and bicycle crashes and epidemic levels of chronic disease, obesity, high blood pressure, and diabetes, Ohio is encouraging more people to choose active transportation and to make it safer for them to walk, bike, and take the bus. Your Move Ohio is a joint effort of the Ohio Department of Health and Transportation to encourage active transportation using the hashtag YourMoveOhio. With me this evening is Kate Harley, who is the Active Transportation Director in Columbus. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You are the Active Transportation Manager of ODOT, the Ohio Department of Transportation. Tell us what that job entails and what you've been tasked to do.
Sure. So I co-manage ODOT's active transportation work along with my colleague Jordan. Specifically, I serve as the statewide bicycle coordinator, and I also help to manage, kind of as one tool of that, our Safe Routes to School program. So we are working on many initiatives to advance walking and biking in Ohio, from planning to approaches with education and data collection, to make sure that we're able to make good decisions and help, improve safe walking and biking in our communities.
Right. Well, and that's an important thing. Adam Dodd from the News Herald, which is up here in Northeast Ohio, wrote a story titled Ohio Department of Transportation Launches Your Move Ohio to Increase Bicycle Safety. So I know that there have been some alarming statistics over the past year in Ohio where bicycle deaths seem to have increased. So what is this new initiative and how do you think it's going to help increase safety?
Sure. So yeah, over the past decade, Ohio has seen increases in bicycle-related roadway fatalities and especially pedestrian-related roadway fatalities. We know that there's a lot of different strategies to improve safety and reduce fatality. And we know that one of the pieces of the puzzle when it comes to that is providing more education to our roadway users. So our goals with the Your Move campaign is to really bring more awareness of behaviors that help keep everyone safe, really focus on some of those critical tips that will improve the safety of our most vulnerable roadway users.
So has this already been launched?
So this campaign started back in 2017. We launched the campaign starting out with emphasizing Ohio's new 3-foot passing law. So we used that as one of our main messages to sort of quickly bring more awareness to this new law that was requiring vehicles to give people biking at least 3 feet when passing. Or to wait until they are able to do so. So we started, a couple years ago, working the Department of Transportation and the Department of Health. There's a lot of shared goals when it comes to walking and biking, improving safety and mobility. And then from the public health perspective, we also know that, Ohio is ranked, I think, 40th out of 50 for health outcomes. We know that having access to physical activity is a big piece of that, but also just having access to affordable means of getting to the places that you need to be healthy. So, together we're really combined forces to kind of have a dual campaign where we are encouraging Ohioans to choose walking, biking, and taking the bus, but also really hoping to increase the safety of people that are walking and biking. And that works together pretty well. We also know that safety is often a major reason why people don't walk and bike is concern about their safety.
Right. We're speaking with Kate Harley. She is the Active Transportation Manager for the State of Ohio, ODOT Transportation. So one of the things in this article that Adam wrote were some statistics that weren't surprising. Most of the cycling fatalities were men, but of course men ride more on the road probably than women. But I'm noticing that the statistics also skewed much older and much younger. So are we not seeing as many people in their middle years, saying 30 to 50, riding or even walking?
Yeah, so I'm just pulling up some of our numbers here related to age, and you're right. We, in terms of male versus female, we do tend to see more males biking in Ohio, and they do represent a larger portion of our bike-related fatalities. That's also consistent with what we see overall for roadway fatalities. Is a majority of those fatalities are men, and I think in the past 3 years. About 70% of our roadway fatalities across the board were actually males. From when we look at our ages, we are seeing bicycle-related fatalities on our roadways in every age group. So when we look at ages at ODOT, you know, our youngest age group being 0 to 4 and our oldest age group being 65+, we are recording fatalities across the board. As the Safe Routes to School program manager, I'm also, you know, looking specifically at the age group of 5 to 14, where we're seeing 12% of our bicycle-related fatalities, which I thought was shocking. But our highest age group where we see the most fatalities is the age of 46 to 64, with just about 1/3 of those fatalities happening in that age group.
Sure. Let's go back to your younger riders and transportation people, the kids who either walk or bike to school. I listened to something yesterday, I believe, that somebody is starting an initiative to actually change the way children are taught about transportation much earlier, as opposed to waiting until they take driver's ed, that they're going to start educating them about cycling. I guess somebody was doing a safety town thing, a permanent one in their schoolyard. Is there any initiative or any ideas? Are there any ideas to educate kids in Ohio earlier about safe riding and walking?
Yeah, there's been a lot of different trainings, from safety towns to trainings specifically. There's one called Girls in Gear to help build more skills with biking at a younger age. And we've seen other school districts in the country that have been implementing bicycle education, I believe, with their second graders, you know, to really provide more skills, because this is an age group where they can't drive, you know, they don't have driver's licenses. For them to get around, they're really relying on walking and biking, and just to make sure that they have all the tools that they need. But I think focusing on driver's education is really important as well. You know, we want our drivers to be aware and looking for people to be walking and biking along our roadways and our communities, you know, especially in areas where kids will be walking and biking to school and parks. So just making sure that we increase awareness, reduce our speeds. When we talk about, like, being able to look for people walking and biking and those, some of those challenges that come up with visibility, a lot of times we're talking about speed and being able to make sure that not only can we see everyone on the roadways, we can, you know, stop in time for them, and things like that are really critical.
Yeah, you know, that the famous "I didn't see him" or "they came out of nowhere," you know, what are you looking at on the road? That's always been a question that I have when somebody's hit, and the first thing a driver says, if he or she sticks around, which is another issue, the hit and run driver, but that's another whole topic. I always wonder, well, what were you looking at if you didn't see this brightly colored, you know, jersey or jacket in front of you? And I don't get that.
That's actually when we look at our like number one crash types, at least for the past 5 years in Ohio, for bicycle-related fatalities, we've seen that the number one cause is failure to detect. So this makes up a little over 1/3 of our bike-related fatalities. And failure to detect is essentially when a motorist fails to see the bicyclist in front of them and ends up colliding with them from the back. I think a lot of different things can go into that. Visibility, like I was saying, related to speed is really important. The faster we're going, the narrower our field of vision is, and we end up missing out on those road users that are often traveling more on the periphery. So, you know, our people that are walking and biking along the roadway. There are, you know, opportunities to increase visibility as a bicyclist. In Ohio, people biking are required to wear a front and back light. And we know that, you know, it's helpful to wear reflective clothing. That can be one way to increase visibility too.
Sure. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Kate Harley. She's with the Ohio Department of Transportation as the Active Transportation Manager. I wanted to ask about whether protected bike lanes are being planned in areas of Ohio, or is that more locally managed, or is that more statewide? How does the state get involved in that?
Good question. I'm not sure I can speak to the plans for separated bike lanes across the state.
Okay.
I know that our first separated bike lane project in Ohio took place in Columbus. So that was implemented just a couple years back, and I think has been, you know, equipped with more of the like bicycle specific lights to help deal with conflicts at intersections. But that's a good question. I might have to do some follow-up with you to see kind of what's coming down the pike.
I just think that if we're going to see an increase in ridership, we're going to need to do something to take people who are frightened to be in traffic away from traffic. And it just makes sense going forward, I think.
Yeah, and I think we're really interested in an approach of all ages and abilities, and really utilizing that as a framework for the types of facilities that we're building, the designs that are being used. We know that separating people, providing bigger buffers, really makes a broader range of our community feel more comfortable walking and biking. So that, you know, that 60%+ of the population that we think is bike curious, we're able to capture more of our people by providing better supportive facilities.
Oh, I like that. Bike curious. What a cool term. I like that a lot. Well, Kate, tell my listeners how they can find out more about what's going on in Ohio in active transportation. Where can they go to look up both what you're doing and what the real, you know, laws are?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So with our Your Move campaign specifically, we're really excited. We've been developing and putting out more marketing and advertising materials. Our hope is that local jurisdictions and partners, health departments, you know, law enforcement, hospitals, all these like cross-sector groups of people who are interested in roadway safety and interested in, you know, getting more people walking and biking and taking the bus in their communities can help us get these messages out. So we are housing our online toolkit at yourmove.ohio.gov, where every day we're getting more things up and running on that website, and it should be fully a full toolkit by the beginning of June. So there are materials for like outdoor advertising, if billboards are something you want to see in your community, or advertising on your bike share, to, you know, digital ads, Spotify. We have a huge social media toolkit that's going to be unveiled in a week for communities with no budget at all, but they want to get involved and get the messaging out. We have some tools and resources for a social media toolkit. And then for more broad active transportation information, our main website is walk.ohio.gov. There's a lot coming out. Ohio is actually starting its first statewide pedestrian and bicycle plan, and we're going to be launching a public survey about walking and biking in your community and barriers coming out in June. So I'd love to share that with you, and maybe you could get it out to your listeners to be able to provide us information.
We will. And I really appreciate you talking with me about it. I'd like to see Ohio move up in the ranks of safe places to bike and walk. I don't like being 40th. That's a bad number. I want to see us being like top 10.
Absolutely. Yep. We are looking forward to seeing improvements in safety and connectivity for all Ohioans. So thanks so much for having me on your show.
And thanks for talking with me this morning. And have a great day.
Thank you.
All right, Kate. Bye-bye. If you're interested in learning more about some of the marketing tools and other information on Your Move Ohio, you can log on to yourmove.ohio.gov. That's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Nancy Hogshead Makar from championwomen.org and Kate Harley from the Ohio Department of Transportation for joining me. Next week, we'll have a little potpourri of people on the show, including Dr. Jonathan Hirsch, who will be back to talk about hip impingement this time. We'll be talking with Evan Friss about his new book on bicycles, a 200-year history of cycling in New York City, and more. I'd like to thank you for listening to the show this week. Remember, you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. Leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Remember to stay safe out there. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.